Now we can come to the main purpose for sitting here in the wave pool under the tent. Our speaker tonight really needs no introduction to any of us. He's been with us a while and he's done a world of good all through the state in promoting the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to make it brief, he's a man I turned to when I finally made up my feeble-minded that I needed help. And I would like to introduce at this time my sponsor and my friend, Bill B.
I tried to sneak in, take my place, you know, just like another blade of grass in a broad and undistinguished meadow, as I always have, as you know. First going off, I want to recognize some people who are here. First, I'd like to recognize Jackie Martin, our new trustee. Would you stand, please, Jackie, and let everybody have a look? And I'll keep my good manners on and recognize out-of-state delegates first, my friend Billy Moore from Kentucky. Here in West Virginia, Louis Southworth, Panel 10. There may be someone who outranks him, but I can't see. I'm getting to the age where I'm a little hard of seeing. I'll recognize Larry Sebastian, Panel 25. Are there any other past delegates here that I can't see? I'm not forgetting our current one, of course, Jerry Smith. Will you stand, please, Jerry? There are two people here tonight that I want to recognize in a different way, and one of them is a repeat. When I first came to AA a long time ago, in 1960, and there are two men here tonight down front who were, well, certainly Louis was here when I got here, and if Harold Craig wasn't, he wasn't long behind. I also want to recognize my parents who are here tonight. Will you please stand, Dad and Mother? And though she just hates it, I'm going to recognize my wife, too, Jeeps. Will you please stand, honey? And no, I haven't forgot what I'm supposed to do. My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'll start where we are. It was a dark and stormy night. Oh, my goodness. We're going to have to be here together for about another hour, and let's try to make the best of it. By the way, I double parked out there, so if anybody has an emergency and has to leave before I do, you better come and get the key. We're supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm going to do that. Much of the story you've heard before, maybe some of it you never heard before. First of all, I'm going to tell you that I feel good tonight. And something else I'd like to get on the record is a couple of weeks ago, I had a very long, a two-hour brain examination on one of those new machines they call MRI, magnetic resonant imaging. The point I'm making is that I've got all these pictures and medical evidence that says that my brain is sound. And I might be the only one here tonight who has recent medical certitude of mental capacity. So, as always, you know, the things I have to say are my responsibility. No one speaks for AA except through its own literature and through our conference. I'm pleased to accept your invitation to speak tonight. And I guess to start at the beginning is that I was born several years ago, 58 and some odd months to be exact, in Spring Hill, West Virginia, in fairly ordinary circumstances, and at home, which wasn't unusual in those days. And unlike a lot of stories that we hear, I grew up in a family with an awful lot of unremitting love. I've been loved continuously all of my lifetime, regardless of whatever happened to me. My parents, some of my friends, my wife, never deserted me, no matter what. I sometimes, you know, we've got all these new things started now, children of this and that, and I thought about starting a thing for kids who've been loved and not dropped on their head and nothing happened to except they took drunk. And in my case, I really can't blame anybody but me. I tried it and I liked it, and I did more. I thought if a little bit did some good, a whole lot would do more. And you know what? I did that until I couldn't stand it no more. Some of you who have heard me recently have complained that I'm a little short on the drunk-a-log, so I'll put enough drunk in it tonight so that you'll know that I qualify. The reason, I really didn't get here under false pretenses, as at least four people can testify, having tended me and had to crawl through some warm puke. You know, I think we've gotten alcoholism so sanitized that part of our problem is that not very many of us have crawled through any warm puke lately. You know, we just go down and pick up the son of a gun and take him down to the treatment center, and 4 or 5 weeks he comes back all better, ready to tell us what it's all about. And that's kind of the way it goes. But I'm going to tell you a little bit. One reason I don't talk so much about my drinking story is that it was so long ago, I can't remember that much about it. Now, I've been in AA since I was a small child, almost as long as I've been married, and I was kind of born married. Not quite, but I grew up and married my childhood sweetheart and have been married to the same woman ever since, which I understand never been one to be overly influenced. Didn't start drinking, or I didn't drink in my childhood. I remember late in my high school, at least after I was old enough to have a driver's license and could drive, going out and drinking a few beers and playing pool or the bowling machines. It's what I remember in particular. It's what I like to do with my friends, and I had a good time. I had a glorious time. And for several years, alcohol was my friend. I didn't get into any trouble. I felt good. I had a tremendous capacity. I could match any party drink for drink and get up, and I felt good. I felt tingly, and I wondered what they were complaining about. And I thought maybe they had deficient diets or something. I always ate good too. And that went on until I was 25 years old. There was one incident on the way to my 25th birthday I'll tell you about. And that is that when I was a very young man, right after I was married, my wife's father was a building contractor. And he gave me a job, and he believed in starting people out at the bottom. In this case, it was the bottom of a ditch. And the way I remember it, most of the days I was there, the ground was about like this is now. And I just hated it. God, I hated that job. I hated getting up that early. I hated doing what I did. And I remember getting up in the middle of the night and looking up the valley and being able to see the lights at Carbide and all of the other bright lights we can see up our valley from a hilltop, and just know that there had to be a better life for me than that. So I answered an ad in a newspaper. It said $500 a week if you qualify. And I went down to see about it. And what it was a job selling encyclopedias. And what you had to do to qualify was to sell 10 sets of them a week. And I had bad luck. I went out my first week and sold 11 sets and made more money than I'd ever made in my life. And that was to set the course of my life for the next decade and introduce me to two things. One was an experience with my first real live alcoholic. He was also my trainer and mentor. His name was Thomas Patrick Aloysius Mariah Xavier O'Shaughnessy. He was an Irishman. He also was an excellent salesman, and he taught me much of what was to make life in a very prosperous way possible for me right up till right now. Tom would go to the bar, and most nights he stayed until midnight or so. A good many nights he'd stay until closing time. And every once in a while he'd just get drunker than hell. And then he'd take to his bed and eat ice cream and drink milk for two or three days, and then he'd be all better again. In between these bad spells, which weren't that frequent, you know, every 6 or 8 weeks, something like that, when he'd feel a little bad in the morning, he'd go down to the bar, and in cities where they were available, he had a drink called a Swiss S, which I don't know what is, except it looks kind of, it's whipped and it's got an egg in it. And it perked him right up. By the time I needed one, I was in a little town in Pennsylvania where they never heard of such thing. And that was after my 25th birthday. We had had a big celebration. I woke up and I was hungover. And I remembered my friend O'Shaughnessy, how he'd go down to the bar and have his drink and go have a good breakfast and get on with the work day. So I felt hungover and I went down to the bar, and I knew there was no way they were going to have a Swiss S, so I got a whiskey sour. It looked like grapefruit juice and kind of seemed fairly decent to drink in the morning. And I did, and it made me feel better. I felt wonderful, as a matter of fact. And I wondered, what was wrong with all these people who were always complaining about having hangovers? If they could take such a wonderful remedy as that, I didn't understand why everyone wasn't well. That was to work all right for me for the next 3 or 4 years. You all know the jury story, or I suppose you do, unless you got there a lot quicker than I did, is that it kept on taking more to get me to work. And finally, by the time I felt like getting there, I was too drunk to go. So that's a short version of my drinking story. The way it was with me when I came to AA, and I'm going to tell this story, is that I was kind of at the end of my tether. I don't know about you, but I know what I did was that I drank as long as I could figure out how to go on doing it and get away with it. I got up one morning. I felt awful. And somebody was banging the door. And I went to answer the door. And it was a deputy sheriff giving me a paper telling me my wife had sued me for divorce. And I went in and sat down and started to think this over. And she told me and asked her what it was all about. And she said that she had had about all this she was going to put up with. And besides that, she called her preacher, and he'd be there any minute. And he was, too. And he told me to quit drinking and give my life to the Lord. And I said, thank you. He left. And she told me that I had an appointment with a psychiatrist that afternoon at 2 o'clock, and she was going to take me to make sure I got there. And I did. And he was a marvelous man, very sympathetic. He told me I probably drank too much while living a marginally successful life. Marginally successful. That got me. Some years later, I was to wind up being this man's sponsor, and he had a a final 8 years of the best of life, according to him, that he ever had. His opinion was that I probably drank a little too much, and I should let up and perhaps have a little more food, and maybe you know, taller drinks with more mixer. Sounded reasonable. I didn't care what I had to do to get a drink. I could drink more liquid if that's what was required, or eat whatever in the hell they wanted me to eat. Then we went on home, and I thought it was a pretty traumatic day, and it was a... And I'd been all this time without a drink. And my wife told me we were going to go to an AA meeting. It was a Thursday night. And I was vaguely aware of AA. I wasn't at all sure what it was. I had some kind of notion that it was something that Lillian Roth had joined when it got too bad. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, never mind. That's a sign that this generation is getting ready to shove on off. Lillian Roth was a top movie star of her day. She was kind of a... We don't have anything like her today. She was a Zsa Zsa Gabor in terms of dress and style, as well as being a very famous actress. In any event, we went to this meeting, and it was in the old lounge on the back of the boulevard, back of where WCHS radio still is. And the meeting was upstairs, and I don't remember, I remember two things about it. And any of you who've ever heard my story have heard this before, I'm going to tell it again, because that's what I remember about it. Is that there were a bunch of people there, and they all seemed happy about it, and they all seemed sober. And that aroused my curiosity. I can understand people being sober if they were locked up, but I couldn't understand them doing it voluntarily. Louis was there, and Mr. Strange, and it turned out that my wife had been there earlier in the day, and had talked to him and found out something about alcoholism and where the meeting was. And that's how I happened to be there. The other thing that I remember was I met another young man who was the same age I was. I was then 29 years old. His name was Jim. He was a truck driver, and he and his wife were there as well. And we started, and for the next half dozen or so meetings we went together, and then he dropped out of sight, and I never saw him but once or twice again until 5 or 6 years later. There was a front page story where he and his wife were both killed in the same automobile accident in a head-on collision, and I went down to the funeral home and said a silent prayer of, but for the grace of God. All of us can say that. We've had friends and acquaintances who are dead from alcoholism who could just as easily have been us. But that had a profound influence on me. Now, I could tell you that in mid-June in 1960, I will tell you, sometime in mid-July it was, in 1960, I attended my first AA meeting, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since, but I took some that weren't necessary. You too, huh? This began a quest. Actually, it lasted 14 years. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. Some of you know that my history in AA is what I smilingly refer to as colorful. Some of you call controversial. And some of you just hiss. Never mind, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how it seemed to me from my point of view. During year one, I sobered up and went to meetings, and just as happy as I could be. I felt good. I had recently, right after I joined up AA and got sober, I got fired from my old job of selling books. I was wound up selling books for 10 years and made good money at it until the last year or so. I didn't tell you anything about my economic condition when I came to AA, and it wasn't good. They had shut my gas off, and my car had a hole in its floor, and I had to be careful when I reached for the brake to make sure I didn't stick my foot through and hit the pavement. And other than that, it was pretty good. You know, I've been in jail 2 or 3 times and had one minor accident. But you all know how that is. A drinking man has to learn to put up with a little inconvenience. If you think throwing up is sick, then we've had different kinds of sick, I'll tell you that. That didn't even slow me down. In any event, shortly after I got fired from selling books, which is hard to do, commission salesman, book salesman, I've seen some who didn't even get fired for stealing. Nevertheless, I managed. I got another job. A guy who had worked for me in the book business recommended me to a man in Wisconsin who sold educational film strips. And this was about the time of Sputnik, when what we're being saved from today's drugs. That's right. Every 20 years we got to be saved from something new. Then the Russians were going to get us with Sputnik, so we were going to teach grade school kids science so that we wouldn't be outspaced. So they hired me to hire and train a sales force to sell these science film strips to elementary school. And I did that just fine. In less than 2 years, I had a national sales force doing well over $2 million a year, and I was making a pile of money. And as you can imagine, I was too busy to go to AA meetings and all that stuff, so I took drunk. And then I came back home, and I want to mention, too, before I forget it, it's been my good luck to have some great AA sponsors and friends. My first sponsor was Al Kelly for a short time, followed by Dick Workman until he died, and later by Joe Pinkston and Bus Robertson. If I have time and think about it before I quit, I'm going to tell you a little bit about why I think a sponsee-sponsor relationship is really important if you're serious about staying sober. In any event, I came on home, and I was still able to sober up at home. And I'd lay in the bed and shake. I didn't believe in God, and I do remember praying. I don't know about that time. I got sober again. I was sober for 2 years and then had a slip. Sometime along in there, and my mother hasn't heard this before, but I'm going to tell it anyway, is that I really didn't believe in God, and I really didn't pray. But one time when I was awfully sick and laying in the bed shaking, she brought a bunch of her friends in, and they gathered around the bed and prayed. And I prayed, too, that they'd get out of there. So I sobered up again, went back to work, went to meetings, did what I was supposed to do. I hadn't discovered we didn't have any service side to AA in those days. That wasn't to happen until about 1968 when Joe Pinkston arrived on the scene a little bit earlier and told us we were supposed to have things like GSRs and assemblies and things like you're participating in now. Our first modern one wasn't until 1968 when George Backus became our first chairman, and a little later when Bob McAteer became our first democratically elected delegate. Before then, as Louis knows, his great friend and sponsor Roy Titus and Dye down in Bluefield, and Jack McCarthy and Morningstar and Wheeling and Tom Hearn and Larry's friend and sponsor over in Clarksburg met once a year, usually at the Chancellor Hotel, and decided who would be delegate and who was going to do what, and that was that. I don't know there's anything too wrong about that. It served us well for well over a decade, maybe longer than that. None of us knew any different. Joe Pinkston got us all stirred up. And you know how we are. After we found out there was something we could vote on, we liked that. We've been coming through storms, sleet, hail, tornadoes. There's no known way to keep us away. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm going to tell you a couple other stories from drinking days and drying up hospitals. Used to be we had two drying up hospitals in our valley. There was Alcan Center, which Louis ran for a long time, and Charleston and Gulf's and St. Albans. I was in both of them. It just depended on which one I thought. I think I favored Gulf's for a while because I found out they had an extra drink in the schedule. You know, that was really my first experience with social drinking. I understand that's the way social drinkers do it. They give you a drink about every 2 hours the first day and every three the second day and something like that. And the third day, one before meals and bedtime, and then you're fixed. And that worked for me for a long time. They give you some vitamins and an awful physic. That's where I discovered citrate of magnesia. And I don't advise you to try it unless you're really serious. A couple of events that happened, it wasn't all dull and dreary and dismal. And I don't believe in dull, dreary sobriety. I've had a ball all my lifetime. I've been happy and had fun most of my life, and I'm happy and having fun tonight. I want to tell you two things that happened while I was in these drying out hospitals. One was that there was one guy there who was fastidious. You know what I mean? who, when he was sober, he was just dressed to the T's and not a smudge on his shoes, and you just knew there wasn't a spot on his underwear. And as soon as he got well enough to walk around, he'd wash his socks, because he'd arrive in the hospital, of course, with just the socks he came in with, so he'd wash them out by hand and put them over the railing of the steps. And then he'd check them every little bit. He'd go by and see them to see where they're getting dry. And I observed this, and I got a washcloth out of the bathroom and got it wet. And every hour or so, I'd go by and give it a little squeeze of water. Going on along toward evening, he picked up his sock and the water was dripping out of it. I said, "You know, it's really damp here on this river bank." He said, "Boy, you can say that again." Well, another event is that I don't know about you all, but taking drunk and being sick wasn't always a real dismal and dreary event. In some respects, when I took drunk, wound up in the hospital, particularly in St. Albans, which is just over the hill from where I lived, it was kind of a family occasion. Jeeps would fill up the car with the kids and our dog. We had a St. Bernard, weighed around 210 pounds, and would come over, and they'd all come in to visit me. The night before, they had admitted a railroad engineer of some size from South Point, Ohio, and he was my roommate. The dog had been there before and knew where I was supposed to be. And he went in looking for me, though I wasn't there. And he said hello to Woody. As a matter of fact, he put his paws up on the bed and put his face right down in Woody's face and had a good sniff just to make sure that it wasn't me. Then he came on into the living room to where I was. 24 hours later, when one of the nurses said something about that St. Bernard of mine, Woody said the first words that he had said since he was admitted. He said, "There really was a dog here." In those days, if you acted a little funny, they put straps on your arms and ankles. And Woody wasn't taking any chances. Well, things went rocking along on about this schedule. The next significant event was 1966. I was sales manager for this firm in Wisconsin. I worked for a guy named Horkheimer. His son, by the way, is now the Star Hustler on public TV. In those days, his name was Foley. These days, it's Jack. So what? You can be Irish and have a name like Horkheimer in Wisconsin. That's about the only place I know of you can. Was a marvelous man that I worked for. I learned a whole lot from him, and he treated me wonderfully, and he paid me an awful lot of money. And after this second long period of sobriety and considerable success, I started to have these spells where I took drunk and I just wasn't able to get to work for, you know, a week or two or three or whatever. And I needed some kind of illness that explained all this, one that I didn't have to wasn't, you know, all that bad, but I didn't want to talk. And I had a lot of trouble getting my wife to lie for me, but if I was persistent enough, she'd do it. She called Horky up and told him I wouldn't be able to go to work that week, that I had laryngitis and I couldn't talk. He said, "Well, that's all right." I said, "Put Bill on anyone. I got something I want to say to him." So I got on the phone, and he said, I know what's wrong with you. And he says, I know where to send you to get you fixed. He said, my daughter and her husband are both alcoholics, and they just got back from a place up in Minnesota called Hazleton, and they fix drunks up there good. And he said, if you go, I'll pay for it, and I'll see to it that your wife gets a check every week until you get back. And if you don't, you got the last dime out of me you ever going to get. So, I volunteered. I was on the... I was on the next plane. I learned a couple of things at that during that trip to Hazleton. One was Lynn Carroll. Some people here tonight remember when Lynn was our guest here in Charleston back when we had the old Daniel Boone meeting. I saw his picture in a recent edition of the Hazleton publication in connection with their tearing down the old lodge, which I was saddened to see. The old lodge was, after Hazleton became a big and very successful institution, which it was big in 66, but it wasn't as big as it was to become. And the old lodge in later days, until the Board of Health or somebody's supposed to have some sense, I don't think's too smart, decided that it wasn't safe for human habitation anymore and couldn't be used. But when I was there and later, it was a place for incorrigibles, slippies, those who probably wouldn't make it, the hopeless ones. I was one of them. But I wasn't in 66. I was just a common garden variety drunk. But I didn't think I was. I thought I was special, different. A couple of things that I remember was that I really heard about the fourth and fifth step for the first time that had any meaning for me. I thought it was just something we read on the wall, like we do how it works and the traditions and all that. I didn't know it was something you actually did. And they told me I was going to have to do that or I wasn't going to get out. They had an old priest there, Father Fee, who had heard over 5,000 fifth steps, so I went in and sat down and wrote down a whole bunch of conventional sinning, stack of papers about like that, and went in and went through it all, and he said that was a fine fifth step, and let me go. And I hadn't touched a thing that was important to me. There was something that was important to me that I heard, not during the regular course of treatment, but on a Sunday afternoon, under a tree when Lynn Carroll was talking to some of us who just happened to sit and listen to what he had to say. He said, you know, boys, if you're alcoholic, sooner or later you learn to discipline yourself or you're going to be subject to the discipline of others. He says, yeah, I know, and it never changes. The story is that you either sober up or you get covered up, but he said there's a lot of time and a lot of steps in between. He said, for some of you, it'll mean going back home and being on a short leash to your mother or your wife or your brother. But in any event, you won't be running your own life. He says, you'll either learn to discipline yourself enough or you'll be subject to the discipline of others. And I just knew that was so. I just knew that was so. And I've never forgotten it. I came on back, and Horky had told me that he'd pay for all this, you know. He also told me if I took drunk again, he was going to fire me. I did, and he did. And so I went into business for myself. Actually, I'd already kind of started in a little way. And I had a good logical reason. I thought if I was in business for myself, I couldn't get fired. And you can't argue with that logic. And so I did. And I had good luck. I was successful almost from the beginning. And By the second year, I was doing an incredible amount of business and making more money than I'd ever made in my life. And then the hard times, things that were to change the definition of life started to happen for me. In 1968, my longtime partner and friend, Chuck, was killed in an automobile accident. And we'd been together for many years. I had to start functioning on my own. The other thing I had to do was to come to grips with death. Until then, you know, it's a condition of the young to be immortal. We can't envision that we'll ever die. And I guess what I really thought up until that time, that if I was merely smart enough, persistent enough, and drove hard enough, that I could do anything. And pretty much that's what I'd done. Death was a different experience for me. That was the thing that, no matter what I did, wasn't going to be reversed. A year after that, my great friend and sponsor, Dick Workman, died. And I was 69. I stayed sober. I was miserable. I spent most of my time in bed. I now realize I had what they call a depression. I just thought I didn't feel good. I wouldn't talk to anybody. I would get out of bed once in a while and go to a meeting. And that was about it. Mostly I avoided everything that I could, except whatever I had to do to save my life, save my business, or to make sure that I wasn't getting into worse trouble than I was already in. That was the only thing to get any action out of me. 1974 was another marking time for me. On the way there, by 1970, after 4 years of sobriety, I took drunk. And from the way I look at it now, I think I had the good sense to take drunk. God knows I wasn't living the way I was. I remember what happened is that Christmas season, I went down my basement and bought 2 or 3 cases of George Dickel, telling myself I was going to give it to my deserving business friends and salesmen and all that. And I went down there and started rapping it and playing that sad Christmas music, you know, I'll be home for Christmas and all that. Didn't occur to me I was already home. Started to drink that whiskey. And in those days, Jeeps had learned a lot. And after I started to drink, she'd put a fifth on either side of the bed and at the end, so whichever way I rolled out, there it was. Her theory was the sooner I got a belly full, the sooner I'd go to the hospital and it'd all be over. And that went on intermittently, mostly on an annual basis until 74. Coming out of Christmas season 74, I just didn't get sobered up. But there's a little thing that happened back about 72 I need to tell you about, which explains some of my colorful history in AA, is that in 1972, the good AAs in Charleston had seen fit to elect me treasurer of intergroup. I'd already been chairman, and nothing eventful happened during that time. But this time was different. I had money, and I was ambitious, and Joe Pinkston was there to urge me on. And some of them been saying it would be a good idea for us to have a intergroup office. I thought that was just a great idea. I'd been in other cities where they had one. And there was one guy on the intergroup who didn't want an intergroup and who didn't like me too good. And I knew that. And he had to go out of town on business. And while he was gone, I called everybody else up and asked them, didn't they think it was a good idea for us to have an intergroup office? And they all said yes, and I went down to the arcade and rented one. I called a decorator and had the place painted. And I had it carpeted. I bought a big table, put it in the middle of the floor. I had a bank of telephones put in. Borrowed a bunch of stuff from Louis, and we were uptown. People, volunteers there answering the phone, and we sent out a notice that the next intergroup meeting would be there in our own offices. I thought they'd just be delighted. You're not waiting to hear the story. They showed up. God, were they mad. Hurt my feelings. The way I did this, of course, was that I asked all my friends, but this time I'd been around like forever, 12 years, I knew who had money, and I went to see them all and put the touch on them. I don't know, I had a couple $1,000s in the bank. We were in great shape. It was just that one little detail, you know, about democratically based. I thought I'd met that condition by asking them. They thought that we should have had a meeting. And hurt my feelings, and I went out and took drunk. Wound up in the hospital and was just awful hurt. And while I was there, some of them that were mad called a special meeting for the purpose of throwing me out because they found out I took drunk. But at that time, none of us had ever heard that you got thrown out of office just because you took drunk. I thought they were trying to make up some rule just to stick me with. And they would have thrown me out, too, except they didn't have enough votes. And you all know that once we have a vote and it's all over, that we just shut up and go along, right? Wrong. They're still mad. So, a month or so later, I did the honorable thing and resigned. It took them another 6 months because the office down had too much money. That was kind of an early brush with my service career. I was disillusioned with the home front, and I started getting more interested in assemblies, and you've seen me here ever since 1970. As a matter of fact, this is... I don't know, 20, 39 of them in a row, something like that. 1974, I just couldn't get sobered up. I went to the hospital 3 times, and I came out just as desperate to drink as the day that I went in. And I experienced one of those things that we hear about in AA that had never happened to me. And I'm talking about that condition of hopelessness. And I had heard old-timers say that they knew they had another drunk left in them, but they didn't know if they had another recovery. I thought, well, you're just one of those poor unfortunates. You're just going to die drunk. I experienced utter hopelessness for the first time. Before, no matter how much it hurt or how sick I was, I thought, well, I can go to the hospital and it'll be just awful, but in a week or so, you'll be better. It didn't happen that time. I was back home and drunk, and I don't remember why I was coming down the steps. And I wasn't doing too good at it. I probably was coming down on my rump a step at a time. And Jeeps and my parents and other family members, I don't know who all were in there, were in the living room. And I could hear them talking. And they used a word, conservator. And I didn't know what it meant, but I was fairly sure I wasn't going to like it. And I went on out to the kitchen and got myself a drink and was trying to sit there and collect my thoughts and see what I was going to do about this terrible emergency. And Jeeps came in and said, do you want to go to Spencer or do you want to go to Hazelden? So I volunteered again. I was to have a remarkable experience at Hazelden this time. All of this time, and I had been mostly sober, and had started and built a large and successful business during the period of sobriety. I still didn't believe in God. During Dick Workman's lifetime, he had a faith that just couldn't be moved, and I kind of leaned on him vicariously. Something was to happen to me during this trip. There was a little lady there who wasn't in the counseling staff at all. She was Dee Smith. Some of you may remember. She was the Al-Anon speaker here a couple of years ago. And she told me two or three things. One was that she gave me a little book called Act As If, and she told me to pray. Never mind whether I... She said, you never have really prayed, have you? Well, I said, I did when I was a little boy. I said, now lay me down to sleep. And she said, I mean really pray. And I said, no. She said, you probably would feel silly if you did, wouldn't you? I said, well, I feel pretty sure I would. She said, well, I want you to go in the bathroom and close the door in the morning and start praying. And ask God to help you stay sober today and to ask to discover what His will for you is. She said, I don't care how silly you feel, you keep on doing it. I didn't have any other good options. I can't tell you that I just believed that would work, but I did it. My counselor, Ed Juergens, some of you have heard him too. He's been a guest at the mill here in the past decade. He helped a lot in this regard too, in the concept of the God within, and as a man thinketh, and referred me to the book that had so much influence on Bill Wilson, Varieties of Religious Experience. And on my own, for some reason, I came on that statement in the big book that kind of says, who am I to say there is no God? And I got to thinking about it. At that time, I think there were 4 billion human beings on Earth, and I thought, what arrogance. You're saying, you know, you thought this matter over, and there's no God, so... Yeah, that's a settled matter. And I never had seen myself with such arrogance before. And I was able to put that aside and to start to believe and to really pray. And that saved my life. I came on back, and you pretty well know the story since then. I'll hit two or three highlights. I'm not going to keep you here too long. It wasn't your fault that we had to get drowned. I had some bad things to happen to me. What I want to tell you about is that I found a God that works for me in all seasons. And I hope that each of you can find that kind of God too. And I want to freely acknowledge the tremendous role that my wife has played at crucial points in my life of being sure that I got to AA, that I got to treatment when I needed to, and otherwise loved me when I wasn't very lovable. In 1974, I came on back, went to work in my business, started making, was already making lots of money, kept on making lots of money. You all started electing me to offices. Over time, you've elected me to every office that's in your power to bestow. And I want to tell you that AA is the defining event in my life. There's no way that I can tell you how much that has meant to me, and how much I love you all, and how much fun I've had in these assemblies. Some of you who go back to the 70s can remember when I was less mellow. We had a chairman and a delegate at that time who also ran Bluestone and who had the poor sense to throw me out. Well, they didn't exactly throw me out. They just came up with a bunch of rules that said that my wife and my dog and my kid couldn't come. And they didn't have any elections about this. So I wrote up a paper and sent it to the General Service Conference and asked them to declare roundups illegal. And they referred it to... They referred it to the delegate from Alaska who had never attended one but thought probably it was a good idea. And that was the end of that, except it made me madder, and I became somewhat of a Talmudic scholar about our affairs. I was conversant with our 12 concepts, as the newcomer is with step one, and I used them all. We had frequent votes on what amounted to votes of no confidence. I remember one time we nearly recalled the chairman. We only missed by 6 votes. I thought it was great fun. It was later, when I was in office, that I understood why these people took it so personal. Oh, well. That's the way it was. 1977, my 21-year-old son was killed in an automobile accident, and I again had to experience death in a very painful and a very personal way. In latter years, in the last year or two, my 2 surviving sons have been extraordinarily disappointing to me. My number one son finally learned how to sell our stuff and thought it was such a good idea he'd steal daddy's business, and that's where that is. My number 3 son is still a drinking and bitter and alienated alcoholic, and we have the 3 little girls. Some of you have seen them. They're 10, 7, and 5. We've now had them for 4 years. If you'd asked me 4 years ago, how would I like to be parent again to 3 little girls, I'd have told you, you're out of your mind. Now, their mother, who is sober from time to time, a while back in one of her sober spells and while she was dating a lawyer, came to see me and wanted to know if she put her life back together, could she have the little girls back? I said, Patty, the only thing you've ever shown a real talent for is having kids. And I'm going to keep this batch, and if you want some more, you can have them. And I haven't heard any more about that. I want to tell you a little bit about sponsorship and how I stay sober one day at a time, and then I'm going to quit. One is that it's been my joy and my experience in the past year to be sponsored to 2 young men, both of whom who were very seriously afflicted with alcoholism, one who had 5 suicide attempts, 2 of which almost worked. The other one had 1. He happened to be a lawyer and was trying to shoot himself in the head with his .38 and wasn't successful, but he had an apartment in the middle of town. The neighbors were complaining. So the cops showed up and they were going to climb through the window, and he told them that he was a lawyer, and if they did, they were going to be in a heap of trouble. And They went to get a piece of paper, and while they were gone, he left. And he hadn't tried suicide since. What I want to tell you is about my relationship with my sponsors, and that is that someplace I got the idea that if I was to make it, I had to be absolutely honest with these men. And over time, I told them everything there was to tell about me. And that's my notion of what it means in the big book. It doesn't mean that we tell all of our stories to the world in general. These two young men, one who's now more than a year sober and the other one is coming up on 10 months, have talked to me almost on a daily basis and have told me everything that's going on in their lives. Sometimes it's boring, sometimes it's scary, sometimes it's interesting, sometimes it's inconvenient. The reason I'm telling you this is that if you're new and if you're serious about sobriety, get a sponsor that you can really level with. Do your fifth step with that person and get down to business. I don't know how to get started toward getting sober until you're ready. God knows I couldn't. I don't know how to get someone ready. I think that we all have to reach that bottom, that moment of hopelessness. I want to tell you how I view life today, and there's a lot of joy in my life today. I live one day at a time, and I intend to be vibrantly alive every day of my life. That's the way I view life. My wife and I are planning a trip to Europe next month. The way I do it today is the way I've done it for a long time. I get up and I pray and I ask God for the ability to stay sober today, and I really do try to discover what God's will for me is. And I don't mean by that God speaks to me in any kind of miraculous way. I think that God speaks to us all through each other, through that small, still voice that we can hear in meditation. And then I report for duty, and I want to tell you a little bit about that. The mental image that I like to have about that is like the way I remember trips to my grandmother and great-grandmother's house when I was a little boy. My grandmother lived way across a meadow, and we had to walk over there. I was always anxious to get there. There were all kinds of just wonderful things to do there. There was a chicken house, for one thing. One time I locked my mother up in it, and it took her an hour or so to get out, and she was awfully mad, but I thought it was real exciting. The chickens hollered, so did she. That was the other thing. There was a cistern with a pump, and I liked to pump the water. But in any event, on Sundays we'd go there, and I couldn't wait to get my shoes off and walk through the meadow on the way to the creek. Along the way, I might step on a flower with a bee and get a sting, or maybe in some fresh cow manure. That felt kind of warm and squishy, too. And by the time I got to the creek and could get my feet in the cool water and the sand, God, did that feel good. And you could lift the rocks, and there were all sorts of things to delight. Crawdads, lizards, wonderful things. It was an adventure, and that's the way my life is today. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm fairly sure I'm going to like it, or at least I can get through it. Thank you for having me. There's no way I can tell you how much I love you, and thank you for all the wonderful things you've done for me.